Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is Chief Curator, Artist, and Author Brian H. Peterson. His latest memoir is titled The Blossoming of the World, Essays and Images. Brian and I will be discussing about his life's work in creating an image of the wholeness experience that includes our objective perception of nature and our inner life. Good morning, Brian. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Just great, Johnny. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Wonderful. I'm so glad to have you on the air this morning. The Blossoming of the World is a wonderful read. The awesome photographs added a very nice touch of drama to the essays and prose. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
I used to joke with people. I was born in Wyoming with a camera in my hand, but only part of that is true. I was born in Wyoming. But I was born and grew up in the West and had a fairly typical, at least on the surface, kind of middle-class upbringing. My father was a scientist, a geologist, and actually a petroleum geologist, and to some degree my early life hinged on where they discovered oil or natural gas in the West.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in Salt Lake City for a while. I lived in northern New Mexico. Then my father got sort of tired of the corporate life and decided to take a teaching job at the University of Montana. So we moved to Missoula, Montana, in western Montana, and I lived there for a number of years before coming back east to go to school. I came to Philadelphia to attend University of Pennsylvania and kind of over the years built a life for myself there. My first love was music, and that's what I initially studied there. But eventually I kind of shifted over into the visual arts and got my master's degree in photography and did quite a bit of teaching for a while. And then through a series of happy accidents, I guess, in a certain sense, I got involved in the museum world some 20 years ago now. And that's really occupied my professional life in most respects since then. So I guess there's a quick, there's a lot of detail I could fill in there, Johnny, but that's a quick guided tour. So.
That's wonderful. I know that you have plenty of work in various museums and galleries today all over the country, and that's fascinating, and we'll get to that later. When did you discover you like photography?
Well, I would say I was in high school. As I mentioned, I was really studying music in those years. That was my, mm-hmm. as I say, my first love, but some of the people I was hanging around with in Montana there were involved in photography also, and I got fascinated by it. And actually, one of my music teachers was learning photography, and he took me down in a dark room and showed me how to make a print. And I was intrigued by that amazing alchemy of an image appearing in the liquid, and kind of got involved with it there. But I never really studied it seriously until I came to Philadelphia. And actually, I finished my bachelor's degree in music and decided what I really needed to do was get some training in photography. So I went to graduate school in photo at University of Delaware. Since I was a teenager, really is when I discovered my interest in photography.
Speaking about music and photography, because those are the two traits out of the three that actually is a chick magnet when you're in high school and junior high, besides being an athlete.
Yeah, you're making me laugh here. I think being the star quarterback is a lot better than being the cub photographer, you know. But I must confess, I guess my first marriage, I did in fact invite my soon to be wife to the dark room. Yeah. There was no hanky panky. However, it was all perfectly above board, and I was a perfect gentleman. But yeah, I. I'll take your word for it, Johnny. I have no personal knowledge of your statement, but if you say so.
When did writing come into the picture?
Well, that happened a bit later. Of course, everybody does writing in college, but what I discovered as I got more serious about it was that in some ways I had to unlearn a good part of what I learned about writing mm-hmm. in college, because the college style of writing is very dry and academic, and frankly, no one wants to read it. And so when I had an epiphany at one point back in the 80s when I started writing little art reviews for monthly magazines in Philadelphia, and then there was a weekly that I wrote for also, and I looked at the other writers in that magazine. I thought, wow, they are writing really interesting stuff. I mean, there's like a good opening line and interesting structure, and it's clever, and it gets my attention, and I need to learn how to do that. So it was really, I guess, practical experience writing for real publications in the world that gave me a feel for serious mm-hmm. writing. And I did do some stringer. I was a stringer for a while. I worked for the Inquirer and some other more national publications. But I always felt that somehow deep inside there was more that I wanted to say. And I did, of course, when I got involved in museum work, do a lot of writing for that as well. But it was challenging and interesting. But again, I felt there was more stuff that I needed to tap into and express. And I was fortunate to run into a mentor. A Canadian writer, almost mm-hmm. by accident, who looked for some reason took me under his wing by mail and looked at some of the stuff I was writing that was more personal and really took me to the woodshed and exposed all of the problems and pompousnesses of it, in a sense, the pomposity of it, and just all the mistakes that I was making, and it was extremely useful to me. So at any rate. It just sort of naturally arose out of my professional activities, you could say, but also as I got more involved in it, I felt this call to do something more personal with it. So I guess that's a long-winded answer to your question.
Oh, that's wonderful. From reading your book, I trust that you are a very spiritual person. And so what happens is that when the student is ready, the teachers will appear. And in this case, being the fact that you guys were corresponding and he's mentoring you and so forth, I thought that was just fascinating. A wonderful story.
Well, I know what you're saying. There's a kind of mystery to that, and I've been mm-hmm. fortunate enough to benefit from that kind of strange serendipity more than once in my life. So I understand what you're saying there, yes.
Fantastic. What was some of the inspiration behind your photography and writings?
Well, this is a hard one to describe in any kind of analytical or concrete sense. I guess I would start with the fact that, as with anyone, as you grow, as you live life, as things happen to you, as good things happen, as bad things happen, experiences build up, things start to percolate. And I would say that there are certain moments in life that stick with me, stick with one, mm-hmm. that You keep going over and over again. There seems to be a meaning in them. There's something that's like a burr under the saddle. There's something bugging me about an experience I had or a feeling or something I saw. And to ignore those kinds of feelings, of experiences, would really be a kind of violation of something very sacred, I feel. So I guess, in a sense, my inspiration was just life and living and then being a kind of inherently creative person, I guess. I need to make things out of that. And I guess that's the other simple answer to your question. Mm-hmm. The inspiration is just I'm just a guy who likes to make things. I don't know why that is. I like to put things together that weren't there before. It gives me a lot of pleasure and it always has and always will, and whether anybody else pays attention to it or not, I don't know. It doesn't in the end it doesn't matter, because I just love doing it so much. So,
do you ask yourself questions a whole lot within yourself? I mean, obviously you're a deep thinker, because being creative, you have to do a lot of sort of a alone time in looking at things from a different perspective, thinking outside the box and those kind of things.
Right. You say I ask myself questions. Help me out with that a little bit. But when you say what kind of questions are you?
If you look at things, a lot of people see, say, for example, one-dimensional. And then you have another person will look at it on multidimensional. And you will be the one that will be looking at things at multidimensional, beyond the three-dimensional,
well,
so to speak.
I suppose if anything, mm-hmm. I do that too much, you know, I would direct you to my wife, and who sometimes, you know, is a Brian. Mm-hmm. You know, do you want a seminar or what? I mean, you know, if anything, I tend to maybe be too, overbearing with that kind of stuff. But the answer is yes. I love to think about things and, you know, I just ponder stuff, and it seems to be how I'm wired. They say if anything, people around me could probably use a little less of it. I mean, you know, some of my friends will joke with me, you know, like mm-hmm. they'll ask me a question, and we'll be having a conversation over a beer or something, and they'll ask me some question, sort of a modest little question, and I'll start mm-hmm. to expound on it, and I'll look up, and they'll be asleep, you know. Maybe that's why I write the book, so I don't have to put my friends to sleep, you know. I don't know, but anyway.
I'm reading your journal, and that's what I'm getting in terms of, it's in the book, and what's interesting is that the word actually that I was looking for is you ponder a lot. You look at things, you know, is that sort of inside the mind, what if, this, that, why? Why is that? It's mm-hmm. to some, it might be the inner child within ourselves that's always, you know, inquiring minds want to know. And to some, it's the creative side. And so that's what it's all about. So it's just fascinating.
Well, maybe what you're talking about with the child, maybe that's really it. I don't know. I mean, you look at the way little kids are, mm-hmm. the way they behave in the world, and they're just naturally curious, and mm-hmm. they want to figure stuff out, and they want to figure out how they relate to one thing or another, and they see one person doing something, and they say, I want to do that too, you know, how do I do that? There's a natural mimicry, there's a natural searching and mm-hmm. questioning quality, but you know, I don't think, in a way, I don't know if I would agree with you that some people are like that and some people aren't. I really, this may sound oversimplistic or Pollyannistic, but I really think it's one of the essential things about just being a human being. It's mm-hmm. what makes us human. We're curious. Unless we're so sort of turned off or shut down by our experiences of the world.
Right.
Everybody has that searching quality, and I don't know if I've ever met anybody who doesn't somewhere in there have a soul that is interested in learning about things and making connections. And I mean, mm-hmm. some of us maybe have it, you know, more excessively than others. I don't really know, but I don't really see it as a sort of us and them thing. I really see it as a very common. Trait of being a human being, you know. So, anyway,
that's fantastic. I mean, it's true because some of us tend to kick it up to the power of 10,
right?
And some of us just take it as face value in some ways. And you're right; every human being has the innate ability to be creative, to ponder, to think, and so forth. So that's interesting.
Also, you're also right too that some people are much more matter of fact and. Mm-hmm. kind of take things as they come, and other people are more obsessed with it, always finding a deeper meaning of things. And there are definitely different personal styles that people bring to this whole thing. So
right.
It's, as with so many things, it's complicated and nuanced and resists a simple explanation.
Well, that brings us to this wonderful question. You taught photography for more than 12 years in a number of universities and colleges. How does one teach photography?
Well, my humorous answer to that would be very carefully, it's, you know, there are kind of obvious answers to that and less obvious. Obviously, there are technical skills that one teaches mm-hmm. that are quite analytical and reducible to rules and techniques and You've got to know your medium. You've got to know your equipment. You can't do anything in any art form without knowing the basic technical language of the medium and knowing your tools. You've got to know what your tools are capable of doing and what they're not.
Mm-hmm.
That's the obvious side of it. But really, I go back to something one of my music teachers told me early on. We was talking about teaching, and he said, well, it's really a kind of osmosis. You can't really learn to be an artist directly through a series of techniques or a series of rules or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You learn mostly by being around other artists and mm-hmm. just absorbing the kind of people they are, the kind of questions they ask, the kind of directions their minds go, the kind of skills they have, the kind of people they are. And it's really a way of life that you're teaching, ultimately. And that's a way of life that's about beauty and growth and communication and searching for truth and all of that, high toned kind of stuff. But
mm-hmm.
it's very real. And then I had a philosophy teacher once who, in college, who talked about the phrase he used was speaking out of the condition. And I think there's a lot to that. When you're teaching, let's say I said to you, I'm teaching mm-hmm. a Zen-like calm about how to be an artist, but I was nervous and flustered and obviously tense and angry and was not really living out whatever the words I was speaking mm-hmm. were saying.
Mm-hmm.
It's really your inner condition as a maker and as a teacher that ultimately is what you're advertising in a sense, or mm-hmm. what you're sending out into the world, and ultimately what makes the most difference, I think. So you can't really be a teacher unless you've trod that path yourself and gotten somewhere with it, because you're not really ultimately teaching techniques.
Mm-hmm.
You're teaching some other more mysterious way of being in the world.
Something very interesting like answer. Yeah, very, very interesting answer. Besides your master's in fine arts, you also have a bachelor's degree in music composition. How has that contributed to your creativity in writings?
Well, I guess you could say it's made me a split personality. but I often think that a lot of my creativity always goes back to my experience with music. I love music, and for reasons that were, almost in a certain sense by happenstance, I ended up going in the direction of visual art versus music. But
mm-hmm.
I'll always be a frustrated composer, and I look at my photography, of much of it, and I see in it this kind of instinctive fascination with line and rhythm and movement and space and a kind of emotional texture, and all those things are qualities that I think slide pretty easily over into music.
Mm-hmm.
And then I look at my writing, I try and look at it as objectively as I can, and what it does and what it doesn't do. And I think as a writer, I'm really intrigued by the sound of the words. I'm intrigued by creating structures, kind of linear structures with a written piece where it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a mm-hmm. kind of shape to it. And I love a sort of poetic feel to the words I strive for that anyway, as they come out of the mouth. And I think all those things relating to sound and movement and rhythm is something that I like to do in writing as well. And so I guess the answer to your question is that music really is probably my underlying inspiration or motivation or
mm-hmm.
foundation, and everything else has kind of grown out of that. So I guess that would be the answer to your question.
Very interesting answer, because what I've got from reading your book is that, to me, photography is generated from the mind, what the mind sees, or the eye sees in this case. And music is purely generated from the heart. And you have the ability to, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, combine those two together in wonderful synchronicity.
Well, thank you. I guess I would say in response that photography can be of the mind. It also can be of the heart. Music mm-hmm. can be of the mind and of the heart. I'm not sure one really has more heart than another,
mm-hmm.
but they're different. There's similarities and there are differences, and I can't say I've really figured them out. Although there's a number of photographers who are very, very famous photographers, in fact, who are also musicians.
Yeah.
The most famous being Ansel Adams. Everybody's heard of Ansel Adams. Well, he started out life as a concert pianist.
Mm-hmm.
He was very, very serious about it, and I believe he injured one of his hands and was unable to continue, and that's when he really got into photography seriously. It was something like that. I may be just getting that story incorrectly, but
mm-hmm.
so I think other people have felt instinctively that there's some kind of connection between those two media, and I've never really read a satisfying explanation, nor would I want to try and write one. It would be, you know, above my pay grade, I guess, or something. That'd be a toughie. I'll wait till I'm and I got another decade or two of living in, hopefully, to do that one, I guess.
So why did you write The Blossoming of the World, Essays and Images?
Why did I write The Blossoming of the World, Essays and Images? Well, I'm tempted to answer, do the famous Sir Edmund Hillary and Mount Everest answer with because it was there, or... you know, the famous bank robber, John Dillinger, who was asked why he robbed banks. He says, well, that's where the money is. I would say I wrote the book because that's where the words were. I mean, that's a silly answer to your question. It's a way of saying I don't really know exactly why I do something like that. I guess if I felt I could kind of glib ease come up with a simple, oh, well, I wrote it because I wanted to save the world, or I wanted to write about the blossoming of sunflowers. You know, it's not really like that. I will say that with this book, my process was kind of different. I'm often very contemplative or meditative or methodical with my creativity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't tend to work in spurts. I tend to work very slowly, very very disciplined. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And with this one, I must say there was something about this book that was almost disturbingly different in a sense that I got into it. I didn't really expect to write another one so quickly after the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was impelled into it. I was impelled through it. Usually when I finish writing an essay or a story, I'm tired and I need to rest. But with this one, another thing would come to me. I'd be writing one. I would finish it. I'd say, okay, now I'm going to take it easy, put my feet up for a while. And then another idea would pop into my head and I was right into it again. There was something about this book that was had a kind of strange inevitability to it for me. Also, I would say again, there are certain things that have fascinated me, that have intrigued me, that I've wanted to really tackle.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, with this one, I felt the chutzpah, I guess you could say, the foolishness to actually dive into some of those things. You know, for example, the first sentence of the Gospel of John in the Bible is one of the most famous passages. It has to do. It's in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Well, that's a very cryptic and intriguing sentence having to do with logos and thought and the Christ and. Now that's a heavy duty thing to tackle, you know, for a mere mortal like me. I'm not Thomas Aquinas or something, you know, but I just felt I felt inspired or impelled that it was time to take that one on. So I did it, and other issues that have become really important to me as I've grown older and experienced more of life. Just the incredibly intense and difficult contradictions that we all experience. experienced as living or organic creatures. You know, the joy of life and the intense suffering that we experience and the beauty and wonder of what's around us, but also the horror and pain and death. And, you know, life is a very complex and contradictory and kind of beautiful and kind of scary thing. Mm-hmm. And I felt a need to kind of wrestle with that and not deal with it, not answer it, but dig into it and just see where it would lead me. Excuse me. So I guess that's kind of why I did it. There was stuff I needed to talk about. You know, forget my. I have a little chug here, so my throat's a little bit froggy there. But anyway.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So another answer would be I like to tell stories, and it's something that I've kind of enjoyed learning the craft of, and stories that are from life or from my mm-hmm. life or other people's lives, and I just enjoy doing that, and so there were some stories that I needed to tell, also some from my family and mm-hmm. That sort of thing. So the most honest answer is. That's sort of why I wrote it. I really don't know. I mean, I don't have an answer, except I kind of needed to do it. So
I'm looking at it from a standpoint as well, that you obviously journal a lot. And I think that while you're going through the process of living, as life is a journey in itself, you were journaling your thoughts
that's
process.
True.
And so that's a wonderful touch to it. And your book obviously blends your philosophical view of life at the present moment, as in the moment at the time when you were writing things down. And at the same mm-hmm. time, the other side of the creativity side of your brain or your mind and your heart as well, we talk about the synchronicity kicking in, you're able to express the beauty of nature seen through your camera lens in reflection of how you feel. And so that's a wonderful marriage that you were able to do, which is it's a wonderful touch.
Thank you.
The next question would be, of course, on a daily basis, how do you deal with life's contradictions that's brought up in your book?
Well, I guess I to some extent I resist the idea of dealing with quote life's contradictions. What I'm saying is a simple kind of facetious answer would be I deal with them by saying fasten your seatbelt, it's going to be a bumpy ride. I don't think one really can deal with these problems that we face. You know, mm-hmm. there's no formula. There's no simple solution. I do have some thoughts about that, though. I've been pushed and pulled quite a bit by life now, and experienced quite a few ups and downs, and a lot of the best that life has to give, and a fair amount of the worst also, and I've really come to the conclusion that the only way to deal with this stuff is to dive in.
Mm-hmm.
That we're really here. The worst thing we can possibly do is be so terrified of life and its problems that we shut down or we fall asleep. I really think we're here. We're born in this life. We don't know where we came from exactly or where we're going. I mean, we have all kinds of feelings about that, but no one really knows for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But we're here now, and we're here to live fully. We're here to experience the whole thing and be awake. And as I say, to me, the worst possible thing is to fall asleep to life, to let all the complexity and the contradictions and the suffering shut us down and close up shop or cause us to deny, live in a kind of state of denial. So to me, I deal with these things personally by trying to let them lead me to a more intense way of just being here right now, just being present,
mm-hmm.
being alive and awake and aware and present I try and get to that place every day. I don't always make it, you know. but I think just ultimately just being present here right now, with you and me here talking,
mm-hmm.
is really what it's about, and in a certain sense, I feel all these problems that we deal with are about waking us up.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's a simple way to. I feel like I'm not saying this very well, but it's a hard question. So. my answer is you don't deal with things per se. You don't sort of now mm-hmm. I figured that one out. I don't have to worry about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You deal with it every day. You let those contradictions and problems draw you more and more into life, because mm-hmm. I think that's what it's really about. It's mm-hmm. just being here, being alive. So anyway,
that's very true. Very true. It's like the moment you are driving on this road of life and you sort of drift away, life would throw something in front of you to kind of get you back on track.
Ain't that the truth? Yeah. So let's just put this way. As soon as you think you've got it figured out, something will come along to, you know, that you say, oh boy, okay, I guess I got to, you know, yeah, so, right. Complacency.
Mm-hmm.
Will not last long typically, mm-hmm. because there's always something down the road that's going to remind you of these sort of harder realities. So mm-hmm. I don't want to be all gloom and doom about it either. I mean, you know, to me, mm-hmm. the experiencing of the difficulties of life, the troubles, the mm-hmm. pain, the violence, the anger, is the other side of the coin, in a sense, of experiencing the beauty and the wonder,
mm-hmm. right?
That if I shut myself down out of fear to the hard and difficult things, then when the moment comes when there's an opportunity to experience something incredibly beautiful, mm-hmm. I'm shut down to that as well.
Right.
So they're kind of the two things. You can't have one without the other, I guess, would be
that's right.
One way of putting it. So,
well, you speak very well with regards to faith, love, anger, and violence. Do you feel that this is the yin and yang that needs to exist to keep the world as we know it together?
Well, these contradictory things, faith, anger, love, violence, I feel it's just the world as it is. I would say if you, in my experience, there is love in the world. There is mm-hmm. hence beautiful, unconditional love in the world. I have felt that love. I try and feel it if I can be open to it every day.
Mm-hmm.
It sometimes some days I hit the mark better than other days, you know. but I feel that love is reality, all right.
Mm-hmm.
But then I don't want to let that blind me to the harder realities too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Johnny, you know, when you read. When the tsunami hits there, it destroys everything in its path. I mean, it destroys the good and the bad. It destroys children. It destroys the elderly.
Right.
It doesn't discriminate.
Mm-hmm.
And as people, we do terrible things to each other, sometimes on a grand scale.
Mm-hmm.
They're just horrible, horrible things that human beings do to each other. And you can't paper over. You can't paper over that. You know, it's.
Mm-hmm.
It's real, but at the same time, the world is just so full of joy and love and beauty and meaning, and being in it is the most amazing gift. And I tell you, when I figure it all out, I'll let you know. Because it kind of, these contradictions are very real, and they do they kind of tear one apart sometimes. I find that really feeling these things really is a challenge, because it's hard, you know. It's much easier to kind of shut down or in a certain sense soothe oneself to sleep, because it's a challenge to, mm-hmm. to be awake. It's a challenge to be awake, let's put it that way.
Very true. You put it very well in the chapter title, Ring. You wrote about the story of the ring, as in Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
As it relates to you. Please share with us your thoughts about that.
Well, that story, that little essay was in the context of a larger one I wrote about me sort of wrestling with my own problems and certain you know, ways I was formed as a child, and the fact that, you know, there are inherent deep problems that I've had to deal with as an individual, and problems that really made it difficult for me for quite a while to really be creative. And I guess I love those Tolkien stories. I love the movies. I love the books. My wife and I we've even ordered the listening recorded books CDs for all three of the Lord of the Rings, which is about, you know, 60 CDs, and we listen to them all. We love them that much. But I got to thinking at one point that the whole story of the ring, as people have to be familiar with the story, but it's this dark ring that was forged back in the ancient past, and it has this power of binding the world together, but in an almost evil way. It's a controlling shape or force in this mythical universe that Tolkien created. And how do you destroy that ring? Well, you can't destroy it through any direct means. But what you have to do is in the story, you have to take it back to where it was formed. Mm-hmm. You have to go all the way through this long, long journey to this mythical fiery mountain where the ring was forged, and that, in other words, you have to go back to the origins of how it was made. And if without getting too psychological, if you think of that as a metaphor for our own psyches, or how our own psyches are formed, I find personally, I don't know if you do, some people don't see things this way, but I find personally that a lot of the struggles I have in life radiate outward and upward from things that happened to me long, long ago, often before I was even conscious. As a conscious individual, I was shaped in certain ways. I was formed. I was treated in certain ways, and this caused me to be, as I say, shaped and formed. And
right.
And there's a kind of long journey in one's life to going back to listening, to understanding as best one can how one was formed. And in doing that, there can be a kind of healing. Now, in the story, it's this one simple thing. You get back there and you throw the ring in the fire and everything is okay.
Right.
You know, in real life, it's something you do every day, and there's, it never actually fully happens, and it's always imperfect, and you're struggling and searching. But I felt there was a kind of meaning that I for me in that story of this long journey, this long search for self-knowledge and understanding and healing that I've had to go on in my life, and I think many, many other people do as well.
You put it in a very wonderful manner, in the sense that every day is a new beginning, and that's why I wanted you to explain a little bit more about the ring concept, because regardless whether you're a night creature or a day creature, there is a point in time in this 24 hours day that we have that there's a restful time where everything shuts down. I'm not talking about our subconscious mind, but our conscious mind. And so it allows you to get back to zero again and start all over.
Yes. Yes, I see.
Yeah. So that's just a wonderful process.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I understand what you mean by that. A sort of daily ritual one can have to calm and get to a place of healing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Well, it's infinite in a way, because this is where the math comes in. You can wait once a year and do a self-evaluation. You can do it every minute. You can do it every second. Because every moment is a conscious decision.
Yes. Yes. That I totally agree with. And I think it's easy to fail that potential. You know, I mean, in a way, what you're saying is similar to what I was trying to struggle to say a few minutes ago about what really matters is being awake now, being present in this particular moment, and just being open to all the things that are possibly beautiful and possibly painful, and just being present in this moment. And there is a kind of decision that you make to do that. It's there's a discipline to it in a way, as well as a search. You have to really want it and be looking for it, at the same time, you're open to serendipity and, as you say, synchronicity and mystery and magic. And sometimes when you think you're most likely to have a moment like that is when it most goes away. And other times it'll just rush in on you, uncalled for, unexpected, and just knock you on your keister, you know. So that's the beauty of it, isn't it? I mean, we're not computers ultimately, even though there's I love computers and our brains look like computers in some ways, but we're not. We're we're these strange, you know, mysterious creatures that sometimes act rationally and sometimes act from other layers that are who knows where they come from, you know. It's a great mystery to it.
Well, it comes from what you talk about, love and fear. In some ways, because when we allow our fear to exceed our love, then we are operating in a different manner. On the other hand, if we allow our love to exceed our fear, then we will experience harmony in everything we do. So that's the interesting part of the equation. Do you believe the wonders of life and the beauty of nature is indeed a balancing act of point and counterpoint?
Well, yes. I believe that wonder, as we've been saying, wonder and beauty are really real. They're of the essence of being alive. And the counterpoint of that is as we've been talking about, the terror of life and the fear of life. Mm-hmm. And both those things are real. In the end, I mean, it's again, I hope I'm not coming off sounding, you know, always talking about the terror and the fear and the because ultimately it's a gift. Just being here, even the bad stuff. I really believe that. I mean, you know, even the bad stuff that we experience is beautiful in a certain way because it's real and it's part of life. And you know, my sister, for example, who's gone now, sadly, but she. Had a little plaque on her wall about something like which I managed to get after she died. It says, "Be glad of life because it lets you play and work and look up at the stars." Well, okay, I'll grant you that's a little hokey, you know.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's simple. It's real. It's
right.
Be glad of life because life is a gift, and I think that's. Ultimately, what we're talking about here, but you're not really going to be able to experience what a gift it is unless you experience the whole thing.
Right.
I guess that's in a sense what we're talking about. So,
and the whole thing is being present in the present moment.
Yes, that would be a one way of looking at it. Definitely, yes.
What is the common ground that unites people and nature?
The common ground that unites people and nature, I will answer that question somewhat humorously, but also seriously. In one word, I would say molecules. In other words, you know, I mean, we're all made of the same stuff. If you read about molecules, they're amazing things. A molecule, I mean, you see these little biochemical picturings of molecules, and they don't do them. I mean, molecules are these incredible vibrating chunks of energy and matter, and they combine in certain ways, and they have all these electrons. The atoms have electrons, and the electrons are in different levels, and there's space in between them, and there's a great. No one really quite fully even now understands what an electron is, or I mean, and we're all made of the same stuff. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in nature with my cameras, and I've had experiences out in the Arizona or Utah desert where I'm just me and a bunch of rocks, a big flip rock. And I swear those rocks are alive. I don't mean they're alive in a way that you and I are alive with this kind of rational language, but I swear, when you're there in those canyons of southern Utah, and those rocks are looming above you and all around you, they have a presence. There is a sense of a kind of life in them
Mm-hmm.
And I feel the same way about the wind in the wilderness. And so I guess I would say the question to me is implies something that about uniting people in nature. I think ultimately there is no separation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, separation is the illusion. We're all made of molecules that are vibrating in mysterious ways, and we're not separate. We're not. It may seem that way because of the way we live, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had experiences walking in the woods at night in Idaho and other places where I've camped, where I'm looking up at the stars, and I know, of course, rationally that those stars are hundreds of billions of light years away. But
mm-hmm.
but there are certain magical moments where I'm looking at them, and I feel I could almost reach up and touch them. There,
mm-hmm.
we're so connected. Everything is so beautifully connected. And so I guess the common ground is that everything is common ground. we're all made of the same stuff,
mm-hmm.
and it's beautiful stuff. It's amazing stuff. I mean, Johnny, I'm here at the shore now. My wife and I are taking a vacation.
Mm-hmm.
This morning I got up at 6 a.m. and I watched the sunrise, and there's this incredible, beautiful, you know, gorgeous light in the sky, and there's thunderstorms coming in at the same time, and there's lightning,
mm-hmm.
and it's just wow, that is amazing stuff. You know, this stuff that we're made of that can produce these incredible phenomena is just amazing stuff, and I'm made of the same stuff. So are you. We all are. We're all miracles, really. I mean, you look at it that way.
That's amazing. That's really amazing. What would you like for your readers to gain from reading The Blossoming of the World?
What I would like them to gain, I guess if I had to word it in one word, I would say nourishment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that obviously not like eating a peanut butter sandwich. I don't want them to chew on my book, literally. What I mean is that there's a kind of spiritual nourishment that I have experienced so many times in so many ways that has informed me and stimulated me and influenced me and fed me and really helped me grow into that my potential to be is. And
mm-hmm.
I've always had, as a creative person, always had a dream of being, you know, of sort of giving back as I've received.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been given so much by so many creative people, both ones that I've known and ones that I've not known personally and physically, but I've known through their work. And I would like to, in answer to your question, my hope is that in some way what I have written will be nourishing to folks,
mm-hmm.
in this way. And that's a tall order, you know. And I say that with as much humility as I hopefully can muster. That, I mean, you know, for example, when I was studying music, I would sit down at the end of a hard day of school or work or whatever, and I would play a Bach fugue on the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be so nourished by that. I would be so centered and focused.
Mm-hmm.
That fugue would put me into a place where I knew what was important in life, because Bach had found it, and
mm-hmm.
he communicated in that little piece of music.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I met Johann Sebastian Bach on a street corner or sitting at a bar stool, I wouldn't even barely be able to say hello to the guy. You know, he was totally different languages. I would say, you know, Auf Wiedersehen, Herr Bach, or so, you know, I mean, that's about all the German I know. But on the other hand, he hit a kind of commonality, I would even say universality of human experience
mm-hmm.
in his work, that continues to be able to nourish people who are searching for the same kind of thing. And I guess that's my dream,
mm-hmm.
my fantasy, my hope that maybe in some small way, and again, I'm not putting myself in the same league as Johann Sebastian Bach, but that in some way something I do can have can be nourishing, can be useful to people in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Very true. I mean, your book is wonderful. It's obviously spiritually nourishing after reading it, because it makes you think a lot about the present moment and the wonders of the world at the same time, and how we interconnect with one another. And again, coming back to the concept of point and counterpoint. So it's just wonderful. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, I think probably my wonderful publisher, Tell Me Press, has been really great, and mm-hmm. they on their website, it's tellmepress.com, I believe. If something cool and interesting happens, they're always good about putting it up there, and there's a lot of stuff about me there, in that, my little section of that website. Also, where I work at the Michener Art Museum in Pennsylvania, if there's something going on professionally there where I'm doing a lecture or an event mm-hmm. of some kind or curated an exhibition, there's always something there about it. I also have a personal website, which is brianhpeterson.com, where I have some selections of my work, and it's a bit dated now. I've got to update it, but those are a few places anyway if people are curious. And then you can get the book through Tell Me Press or the Michener, or certainly through Amazon or any of the other sort of, major online bookstores and Barnes & Noble and that sort of thing too, I believe.
Wonderful. One last question with regards to your book. Please share with us your final thoughts on this passage. I thought it was just a wonderful passage to end the book. We are words in the story of the world. Who wrote the story? We call it God, only because to talk about it, we need a word, and that's the one we agreed on. Brothers and sisters, I'm here to tell you this story is still being written. You and I are writing it too, writing it with our work, our love, our lives.
Wow. I guess I'll start with by just quickly saying that don't we have the feeling sometimes that all this important stuff happened in the past?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the gospel stories happened in the past, and various other formative stories and experiences of religions happened in the past, and there's this mythical quality about, the past is what's really real, but we're just these kind of ordinary Joes going and Janes going about our business, and what we're doing is nowhere near as important as what happened in that mythical past.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't see it that way. That's one thing I was trying to say in that passage, that mm-hmm. the world is being formed, is being created right now. We're in the mythical past in a sense. Our lives really can make a difference, and it really matters the decisions that we make and that we care about stuff that's important. And when I say the story is still being written, to me it's a sense of life that's dynamic, that's always alive, that's unpredictable. And dive in and enjoy it. Take a big bite of the apple. drink the whole cup. I mean, that's what's why we're here. And just go out and make things, do things, love and live. And like my sister's saying, look up at the stars. I mean, that stuff's all important. The thing about God, I find God to be a very difficult and dangerous, problematic word.
Mm-hmm.
Because people use that word and mean all kinds of things and have all kinds of intentions. I mean, sometimes the word God is used almost like a weapon mm-hmm. to keep people down, to control people. It has so many connotations that are so contradictory and difficult. I try not even use it that much because all I can say is, for me personally, there is that experience I've had. I believe, I know that there's something out there, there's something in us that is more than us, that is a kind of consciousness, a kind of love. I believe that's there, but I'm really, really cautious about it, and the last thing I want to do is impose my experiences, my beliefs on anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to be careful using those words. That's why I was the business about God. We talk about it because we need a word. Mm-hmm. That's the one we agreed on. I think whatever that phenomenon is, it's something we're all, if we're open to it, striving and struggling to understand. And frankly, there are many, many people I know who are not religious in any kind of obvious way, mm-hmm. who are searching and struggling and grappling with these questions and are just as spiritual and focused on these problems as someone who does it within a context of an organized religion. I think we are all brothers and sisters in this search, and I guess that's what I was trying to convey in that passage. So.
Wonderful. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with all of our listeners this morning?
My recipe for living, I have no recipe. I accept sort of bow your head and muddle through. No, I mean, I don't really mean that, but my recipe is just simply to, as I've said, as we were saying, to live, to take a big bite of the apple, to do whatever it takes to stay awake, and don't let the problems of life kill your spirit. But if anything, let those things lead you to loving life and being in life all the more. That's a tall order, and I don't have a recipe or a set of rules or guidelines to do that. But I think it's possible, and every day, as we were saying, is a challenge and a struggle to find that. And so that's my recipe. Just do your best to stay awake and live and look up at the stars and take a big bite of the apple.
That's fantastic. That is a wonderful recipe, because being in the present moment, being conscious of what you're doing. So that's fabulous. We got about a minute or so. I do have to ask you this. This is really interesting, because we hear a lot about curators and so forth. You are a chief curator. What exactly do you do?
Chief curator would, it's more like, what does a chief curator not do? but I've done everything from sweeping the walks to cleaning the toilets to working at the front desk over the years. But no, my job is really basically exhibits. I get involved in exhibit management and exhibit conceptualizing and the endless details of getting the art on the walls. Also, it involves research and study and thinking about art and trying to translate art into language that is accessible to people, but stays true to the subject matter. So it's partly managerial, administrative, and partly conceptual and scholarly. I guess you could say would be a quick answer to the question.
Fantastic. So, that's wonderful, because I mean, that's often the question for me personally. If nothing else, I'm always curious about what does a curator do. And, of course, in this case, you're the chief curator. So that's wonderful. Brian, thank you for the great recipe for living that you shared with us just now, and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be award-winning short story writer Michael Schiavone. His debut novel, titled Call Me When You Land, is about a broken family striving toward repair. Michael and I will be discussing about his life's journey and his debut novel. For additional information about this show, future shows, and to receive a free recipe for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week. Brian, thank you again and have a great day.
Thank you, Johnny. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.